This is episode 4, Charlie, of Free as in Freedom.
Hi, I'm Karen Sandler.
And I'm Bradley Kuhn.
This is Free as in Freedom.
And we're at the last FOSDEM talk.
Hooray!
So this is from 2013. This is more than a year and a half ago.
I know.
Just so everyone knows.
And I was wondering if we were going to talk about more current things too. Because it's funny, because I wanted to talk a tiny bit and just tell people that I keynoted at the Texas Linux Fest, and I think that talk is online.
And that will be a very long time ago by the time...
I guess it'll be a long time ago by the time this is released, because we're recording. We're getting these episodes down. We're committed to not having another hiatus.
And we're giving a hard job to producer Dan now. So
yeah, he's awesome.
Yeah, but that's the situation.
If you know Dan Lynch, tell him he's awesome. If you know him, you already know that he's awesome. You can listen to Linux Outlaws.
So this is a talk by Simo Source, which he mentions in the beginning that that I recruited him to give this talk, and he didn't want to.
I should mention that Simo has the best last name.
Yeah, but it's not spelled that way. He gets upset when people spell it wrong.
Yeah, but he could make a joke if he wanted that there's no U in Source. But that's not a very free software mentality. No, but it's funny.
So Simo gave a talk about free software licensing and licensing issues from a developer perspective, because I felt like the dev room the lawyers just come out too much.
It is a legal and policy room. I mean, I think we want the expertise
and
of
lawyers
in
have
our field.
Gone to Hogwarts and the rest of us haven't, so they know there were just these muggles who can't possibly talk about these issues, so we should only let lawyers speak, right? That's
well, obviously not
philosophy.
But we do want a good number of lawyers. We always have a nice balance. We always have non-lawyers in the room, whether it's
well,
the right
more
balance
recently,
I'm not sure.
But back then, I mean, think back to 2012. Remember, we're way in the past. 2012 we didn't, and that's why in 2013 I actively recruited people to speak who weren't lawyers.
Didn't we always have non-lawyers speak?
Yes, but
we always
most
had you
them.
Speak, and you're
no,
a non-lawyer.
I didn't give a talk of my own. I was on panels, but I didn't give a talk of my own until 2014.
Oh, but you were a speaker.
Not until 2014.
Well, you were on a panel, so you were a speaker.
Sort of. So.
Anyway, here's the talk.
Okay, I think we're ready for your next talk from Simo.
Yep. Okay, thank you. Just an apology first. The title seems to be something that may be contradictory or cause discussion. It's just a title. When Bradley asked me to make this talk, it was such an idea to do something about licenses or not. He was really insisting that he wanted a developer's experience, less about lawyers talking about this. And during the days, coming to our FOSDEM, I changed my mind on what I was going to say. He was insist every time was a bit dubious. He was.
Can you speak up a little?
I can try. He was going to say, "Now I want the developer perspective," and this sort in. I say, "Well, you want the developer perspective? I'll try to give you that." However, I don't want to monopolize my own talk. I would rather prefer to have discussion because I'm just one developer and I cannot possibly say what is the developer's perspective on my own. I can give you my own idea what it is, and I can give you what I think may be an important point, but I would really rather have a discussion about the point that we make, whether they make sense or maybe not. Just one disclaimer, I work for Red Hat, but everything I'm saying has not been vetted by Red in any way. I am also involved with other organizations like Samba Team. I am also involved with conservancy to some degree. So all the opinions here are my own, and that's it. I was trying to understand what is my perspective, what is the developer perspective, and I have to go back in time because my own ideas on free software, of course, have changed. And I've been involved in free software for many, many years now. Way too many, probably. and I was trying to recollect, how did I get involved with free software to understand, you know, if my perspective had really changed. And the only thing I can remember was the incredible confusion I had when I first encountered something that was free software. It was really hard to wrap my head around what was copyright applied to software. I had no idea what was copyright at all, probably then. And I think by my interaction with younger developers these days, that it is pretty much still the kind of experience new developers feel. It is a bit different. I'm old. When I started with software, not even free software, I didn't know about the internet. I didn't have a modem. I was working at home, my own. And I actually got exposed to the internet only when I got to the university. Today, it is different. People get exposed to larger software community and free software communities much more easily, so they probably meet this problem early in their life. But I think it's still very difficult for people to wrap their heads around software licensing. And they really, really actually have to only when they get in contact with open source software. Because for everything else, the licensing thing is really much more downplayed. And my experience is kind of confirmed when in my company we hire someone that comes from proprietary development. They tend to have no idea what open source is and what licenses are. In proprietary companies, still, I hear people that it gets said, you don't look at licenses, you don't look at other people's code, don't read GPL code, still, even though that is changing. But I can still find people that get told, don't look at, you know, open source code, you will be tainted or whatever. And so these guys have really no idea what copyright is or what patents are, right? That's IP, this new term, or not even here, this term that is thrown by lawyers all the time, and they leave it at that. It's not their job, it's not their business, so they don't really have no idea. So that's, you know, my point of view. The next thing, which is what introduced or may introduce people to actual legal issues of software licenses, are reading a license, except that nobody reads a license. With proprietary products, ELAs are the only thing people may get in contact with. I haven't never seen anybody ever reading one of those licenses, unless they are lawyers or real advocates that have already a history of understanding copyright issues. And even them often don't read basic documents. Some brave developers instead sometimes read the license, especially when exposed to free software. Free software licenses tend to be small enough documents that some people may venture in there. My experience is that most remain quite confused. The problem is that they have no background to understand what a license really means. Because a software license relies on a bunch of laws, copyright law, and a bunch of others as well, that simply the normal person have no idea what they say and what they mean, and even just the language itself necessarily needs to be the language of the law is confusing because the meaning is not what the person that has never been exposed to the language might think it is. So it's understanding license becomes simply, you know, beyond whatever people having the willingness to do it. It's just too much work. There are some nut cases, like me, that actually tried to understand what it is. That was my case. I got sucked into this legal stuff by curiosity. I think I have a decent grasp of what these things mean. I'm not a lawyer at all, not even close. I probably misunderstand no less than 50% of what I read still. I try to form an opinion on things, but again, you know, there's only so much that someone can do without having an history or, you know, preparation on these matters, because it's really complex stuff. And the rest of the people that don't care, probably don't get even 10% of what's really behind the license, beyond the actual, you know, feeling good or bad about it. Because the main thing drives people, I think, in free software is the way they feel about the license. They may feel good or bad about it. The fights I see are just, you know, I like GPL, I don't like it, or I like this license, I don't like it, I like open source, I don't like it. But it's not because they understand the legal nuisance behind it. It's just a good gut feeling. Sometimes placed with, you know, financial motives or whatever else, but it's not about the actual meaning of the software. And so I was thinking, you know, is there anything we can do to help letting people understand better the licenses? Maybe LCC way? I mean, this is an actual question I'm making. If you want to answer it, if you have an opinion, please. I really want to be interrupted. Because I don't have an answer to that. I heard guys some interesting opinions in the talks in this legal devroom yesterday and maybe today, and talking to people around. Some people dismiss it because they don't like the CC license's way of representing what the license means. However, Richard Fontana talk kind of raised the point again, that is, you know, license is complex. Please.
As you're asking for reactions, what I think is the fact that while the Creative Commons licenses, the way of working with the small logo is pretty simple and doesn't really cover stuff, it's better than just saying this is GPL version 2, because it says nothing for most normal users. And so I think that the CC's option of like giving a very simple icon, meaning already something more than just a little line of text saying some obscure name of a license, is already better. And perhaps some kind of summary, like an option in between just a simple logo and the full text, might also be an option to get people to start understanding what their license is really about. Those are things I've been.
Mm-hmm. It's a very good point. Thank you. Does anybody else have a different opinion about that? Just feel free to, please.
Yeah. Often the main points of a license are like very easy to grasp, but it's all these special points. What if I make a special use third part libraries and want to connect with them, or if I want to use something in between?
Perfect. That drives me to the next question. Does it make sense to do that? I don't have an answer to that as well. I have the concept you have, but I also like his answer. So, does it really make it better or worse? Because from one point of view, you could say it makes better because at least people have a grasp of what they're buying into when they start developing software. On the other hand, as you said, is it going to conceal the real nature of the license? Is it going to make it too easy and people, you know, get tricked in believing something that is not necessarily true? I don't know. It's a very good question. I think it's a question that, you know, this kind of audience should think more about.
Isn't there a hidden assumption here, basically, that the developers are actually making rational choices about licenses, whereas it might be that it's anything but that?
No, I'm not making any assumption about rational choices by the simple reason my premise is that they don't understand the licenses. So it's impossible for most people to do a real rational choice on the license. So I'm not saying that they are completely rational either. I mean, they have some information and they can work on the information they have. So it's not like they're just, you know, playing roulette. But it's a very important point what you're making, of course. How do we help developers make a better choice for themselves? That would be my idea.
So are you targeting? Is the question about the users of the software or the developers of the software?
I think it's a question for the users, the developers, and the legal community.
Because they're all different use cases.
Yeah, of course.
Because
but they all have a problem. Users have a problem understanding.
I don't think
what
the legal community has a problem.
Hmm?
I don't think the legal community has a problem.
They're
doing what they've always
done. No. I think there is a problem there. I want to explain that. That's very good. A good point. I want to explain what I think is the problem.
Okay.
I think, and that's actually my last point. I think that the problem is that the legal community advocates risk leaving the developer communities behind. And let me try to explain why that. I came here, and I have been involved with legal matters and free software for a long time. However, in the last 6 to 5 years, I've been rather busy with actual software development, and I left all my advocacy work behind for 7 years. I was, I have been in the anti-software patent movement when I was still living in Europe. I was connected and working actively in free software advocacy groups, organization. I had contacts with FSFE, with the Italian community where I was born. And I come here, and there are some things I'm not aware of anymore. Now, I have a pretty strong background in this stuff. And I come here and I'm surprised by something. And that made me think, if I am surprised by these things, I'm not completely foreign to it, what do you think a developer that doesn't have an exposure to legal issues can understand? I mean, I wouldn't be able to understand half of what was going on. I mean, even just where the question comes from, where were the problems? I cannot begin to understand. So my concern that was really reinforced by being here past them was, aren't we? I'm not complaining about we moving too fast or moving too much ahead. Is are we leaving people behind? I mean, should we do more to not do that?
Could you give an example what surprised you? Because this surprised me.
I think some of the discussion on the derivative works, I was pretty familiar with that, but there are some derivative works. I cannot give you really a list because I'm still digesting. I'm still digesting this stuff, but I got this feeling there are some things I'm not really able to grasp the way I would like. And so, I mean, it's just yesterday and today, so I haven't had time to internalize all this stuff. So I don't want to concentrate on any specific example.
Well, without having heard Till's lecture on derivative works, but I've been involved in that subject somewhat myself, I would say it's not so much as leaving behind as that free software having content forces legal professionals to revisit parts of copyright law, probably copyright law, but probably were there for about a century probably even, but are now laid there. It's not so much as progressing further as more as the rabbit hole is somewhat deeper than we thought it was.
Oh yeah. But that's fine. I mean, again, I'm not saying that there is any reason to slow down or change that, but I think we're getting a bit complacent. I think as this legal community, we're starting giving for granted that a lot of people really understand the issue, even developers. I think we are a bit more, we think developers understand more about software license than that actually is, and that actually may not be true.
So if you care and you're a developer, I think there's really good resources for giving advice on picking a license, which are, I think, pretty easy to understand, but most people don't care.
Yeah,
so
true.
Is that a, I don't know if that's a problem necessarily.
Well, I mean, from my point of view, it is. And it is because these people Well, a lot of developers have a career. They start small, they start with something, but they grow and they go on. And when they go on, they make decisions.
Right.
And they have more and more influence. And if they don't understand the decision they're making, they may just settle on a set of decisions that may not be optimal. Not saying they're wrong.
Right.
So, yeah, this is the kind of thing I'm really, this is the main point I want to drive as again with my talk. But I will go on with a bit of history about how I got involved in this stuff. That might be, may give some insight, maybe, you know. But if you have questions that rise, or, you know, keep asking. So, impact on the first license. I was thinking about that again while creating this talk, and I realized that the first license I actually met was the GPL. That might not surprise you, but it did surprise me now, not back then. And I learned about it because of Linux. And I didn't learn about FSF when I met Linux at all. And I don't think that's a problem. However, I have never read the actual license, although I knew it was there. I had a sense of what it was. I had a sense that I liked that license because it allowed me to get the software. But it hadn't, I had no reason to read it. I think like for 4 or 5 years after I met Linux, I still haven't read the license at all. And when I finally read it, I found it awesome. But I wonder if it was an imprinting effect. I wonder if I found it awesome because it was basically the only license I was familiar with. And because I had agreed to the social construct around Linux, it was about sharing, and I saw it, you know, its effect in action. So I wonder if I liked it that much because I liked the environment it created more than the actual license itself. And in retrospect, now that I know the license and I learned a ton more stuff, I think I did not understand anything. So it was probably an imprinting effect for me. And I wonder if that's the same for other people. So why I think Kotlin is awesome? mostly because of this reason. And I think this is the reason that I subliminally understood back then. I probably wouldn't have been able to express them back then, but they haven't substantially changed. And so the reason why I like it is because it allows you to create a community. In that case, was Linux, then was Samba. It really is a strong bond there, and it's excellent for very hard technical problems. The two projects I like the most that use the GPL are Linux and Samba, and they both were faced with incredibly challenging technical problems. Linux for the complexity of the kernel, Samba for the complexity of the coding, the completely proprietary protocol at the time. And so they were very challenging problems. And by sharing knowledge, it was much easier to practice problem. And so that's why I like it. I like the fact it allows you to use a lot of existing code when it's compatible. And I like it because if you do not want proprietary forks, it works very well. So these are still the same reasons I had back then. Maybe not the last one. It wasn't that clear to me back then. But there was this sense that, you know, it's free, but you cannot do really everything you want to do, but there are some rules. Okay, then I learned about permissive licenses. After I got exposed to the internet for real, and it did change my perspective. It didn't make the GPL less liked by me. And I did not understand what the permission license, but what the point was, until I finally found what Berkeley means. Because I'm not from the United States, and this is a point I would like to make. Sometimes there are bias in licenses that come from the US culture, legal culture, and pop culture as well, that other people in other countries might not understand immediately. And it's another barrier to understanding some parts or some history behind licenses. For example, the whole BSD versus GPL or versus MIT stuff, it's something that is completely nebulous for anybody that has not been living in the US and does not have any idea what it means competition between superior technical institutions, like the universities of the United States are very competitive, so some reasons why they have their own licensing and stuff like that comes from that. That's not something I've ever found in Italy or perhaps in most of Europe. And so I learned about permissive licensing. After that, for many people, older than myself or that have been in the US before I came, it probably has been the reverse. They learn about BSD first, and then the new project got known. So that might have an impact. And might still have an impact, which one you meet. I think the imprinting effect works if you first meet the permission license, and it might be, or maybe not, that's why some people are really strongly in favor of Apache or BSD licenses, and some others are for the GPL. I think the imprinting effect is important. What is the community they, you know, they are exposed first. So why they are awesome? I like them. I like all the licenses. It allows you a lot of things, and I've used permissive licenses even recently. And this is what I learned after I made them. It allows you to dump code, just abandon it. You don't care, but it allows, you know, someone else to pick it up without any problem. It's excellent, I think, for reference implementations where you really don't have a reason to keep them free, as in the copyleft sense. It is excellent for implementing differential standards where it is much more important to have software interoperate than keep it free. Because the very fact that it cannot interoperate can allow you to keep the freedom of your software all the time. Because network effects are really important, and sometimes you have to give to avoid fragmentation and, you know, to avoid proprietary products being using different stuff, I think. So file formats, networking protocols might benefit from releasing software with permission licenses. People may not agree. I mean, if you don't agree, speak.
So, we use BSD license at my company, mm-hmm. for ISC, for Bind. The main reason we do that is because, well, we are a reference implementation, mm-hmm. we implement standards, networking protocol, and we want people to make it proprietary. Mm-hmm. And I hate all of that. So,
but
it,
still
because
use
what
it.
We see is that instead of preventing forking, it actually enables people
oh, yeah.
to make proprietary extensions. It also kills your sense of community because companies don't give back. We've had cases where we reported to customers that we've had problems and they said, oh yeah, we fixed that 2 years ago. And it's like, well.
Yeah, as you might notice, I don't put the create strong community in this slide. Why the copyleft one.
And to be honest, I don't really understand why people use permissive license instead of just putting it in the public domain. That doesn't make any sense to me.
Yeah, I put the public domain in the same bucket as permissive licenses because it's the ultimate permission. Do
right.
really whatever you want. I don't
right.
care.
So, believe it or not, I'm probably best known for GPL enforcement, but I've actually done a little bit for some of Conservancy's projects BSD enforcement. There are cases where they are BSD licensed developers are upset at the failure to reproduce copyright notices. I know ISC license doesn't require that, but BSD license does.
Right.
And when you proprietize, you have to keep those copyright notices, and they want credit. So it's funny when people talk about, like, well, permissive license, you can just do whatever you want. Well, if it's BSD, you have to preserve copyright notices. So there is a certain amount of, they want attribution more than they want.
Well,
the code
point to the license is to make me preserve the license.
Give me credit.
Yeah, give me credit. I want credit where credit is due. That's the BSD philosophy.
It's
different
ego.
Than the ISC because it doesn't require that.
Ego and reputation.
Yeah.
That's all it is.
Yes. Right? True. So, I wasn't planning to give any advice on what you should use or
sure.
why.
Sure.
I really don't like that. But personally, when I choose a permissive license, it's not for a full product.
Right.
It's usually a very small utility, or actually a portable implementation, so maybe a library.
A library, yes.
Maybe not even complete. I think there are some successful products, that are completely BSD.
Yeah.
I think.
You like OSX?
Huh?
You mean like OSX?
you could argue that this is
that's
but,
my point.
I think they actually have the problems, that all of them have the problems, you say. They do not benefit from their license.
Right.
So if you're looking for a license to benefit your own project, I think the permissive license might not be appropriate. But it is your choice.
Sure, of course.
So, and this is one of the reasons why I think simplifying licenses might make sense, because some people do not understand this point. But again, how do we convey these problems if you try to simplify? I mean, I would be conveying an opinion. And is it right to do? I don't know. I don't think so. On the other hand, I would like to convey the experience, at least. Because I want to empower software developers to understand their choice, not make the choice for them. Next argument. Oh, dating CLAs. I was forced to date a CLA. And I've read that. This is the project I've been working for the last 6-7 years. And when we started, our legal department wanted to experiment, let's say. It's not probably not a real thing, but there were CLAs already in use in Red Hat. But I think it was part of also an experiment to try to study a CLA with some project that was just starting from scratch. And they asked us to use a CLA with a creative project. And I didn't like it at all. Really instinctively, I was repelled. And turned out I had good reasons to really not like it. And the good thing is eventually we convinced the legal department to get rid of it. However, some minor damage was done.
Your lawyer's making a funny face.
Yeah, Fontana helped me. I need to get credit. I was waiting to do that.
Well, it was a mistake, but actually, yes, I remember talking to you about it.
Yeah.
But then later on, I agreed with you. I think I probably agreed with you all along. So
we
got rid of it.
By the time we were talking, me and you, we already were like 99% in agreement. Because I didn't bring it back to legal until I knew there was a chance to discuss it positively.
So what happened there was Red Hat, I think, thought that you had to have CLAs for...
Yep.
For open source projects, so it was just something that everyone did. I don't think there was very much thought about it otherwise.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think Red Hat thought about the consequences, and it wasn't intentional. It wasn't evil from Red Hat. It was really an experiment, and that's why I both hated it but also accepted it at the time.
For clarification, what type of CLA was it?
Just require. I don't.
It was an Apache. It was an Apache
right.
Style.
I don't actually even remember because I hated so much that I really don't
remember. Do you have to sign a fax?
Yeah.
Okay.
You had to sign and fax it.
Could you explain what the good reasons were for hating it ultimately?
Yeah, I'm getting to that.
Okay.
Actually, next time. Why they are evil? they are very cumbersome legal documents. Even when they are short, they are very difficult for developers to understand. Most developers I know in free software have my saying gut reaction of hate. So it pushes some developers away just by the fact that you have the CLA letters anywhere on your website. That could be bad enough, but some developers persist, they want to contribute. And it is often completely impossible. And that's the evil in the CLA. It's not that the people may have bad gut feelings, it's that they simply cannot contribute. So the case that really confirmed that the thing was bad and I had to work with legal to remove it is that I had a developer that wanted to contribute stuff, but he was working for, I think, a university, and there was no way he would get through all the layers of legal, you know, in some university, to get approval to sign a CLA. And this was, you know, a guy that was working in a very permissive environment, like a university. Think about someone that works in a government agency, has nothing to do with software, wants to do it on the side, or does it because his job requires him to fix something and wants to contribute back a patch. There is no way he would even try. And so this makes them evil. And the reason why Red Hat, I think, would try to do CLAs was the legal maintenance problem. And was the reason why I accepted doing CLA. I will come to the questions. Because at the time, and still now, I believe the legal maintenance is a real issue that needs to be addressed in a project. However, the CLA is probably not the answer. Let's take the question.
Well, two actually. First, if someone is unable to get through the lace rotation of his or her organization for a CLA, that person was probably not authorized to release the patch involved under whatever license to begin with.
No, not at all, not at all. In some places it's much easier to contribute software under the copyright of your employer. Because the problem is that that is something that is already sort of codified. And it's much easier to do because they retain the IP, so you're not going to the lawyer asking something completely crazy. You're going to the lawyer and say, well, there is IP, they need it. I mean, we retain the copyright notice, we have attribution for the university, for the governmental
thing. They assume that every CLA is about assignments.
Right. You have to transfer copyright. Means
no, that's copyright assignment. CLA is much less severe.
I know.
Most CLAs, and including the type that was used here that was modeled on Apaches, are very similar to copyright assignments.
Yeah.
They basically grant very broad relicensing or sublicensing rights to the inbound.
But let me cut the argument short. Even though it is not an actual copyright assignment, the language that is used and the effect are so close to it that the lawyers treat it the same way, whether it is actually or not. The process you have to go through is basically the same. So it doesn't really matter what is the actual legal construct you're using. It makes for a completely different process within a company or...
In my experience, it makes a huge difference, actually.
Well, okay.
My employer would never sign a copyright assignment, but if I'll sign a CLA that basically is the equivalent of a BSD license outbound.
Sure, I mean...
Which is what the Apache license is supposed to be. It's effectively the same as... a BSD license, do whatever you want,
and
don't
find
the road.
And that's perfectly reasonable. I mean, I'm not going to say that it's not true. It is true, but the experience is different with different people.
Sure.
And different organizations. And your organization, I know you, your organization is exposed to something. Some organizations
sure.
are not.
Sure.
For those, it's completely something
right.
new, so it's
sure.
really difficult.
And the other question was, how do you feel about the Project Harmony CLA model?
So I have to be honest, I haven't followed it. I didn't like the premises, so I just ignored it.
Okay.
I just ignored it. I hated the CLAs so much.
Yeah.
That I don't even want to know about this thing. And that's not my own feeling only. I mean, I'm not saying I wouldn't sign a CLA necessarily. I know what they are now.
It's not very helpful for the debate if you wouldn't want to know about them before.
Well, I know that, but that's the developer perspective that you hear. I mean, I'm not the only one. I know a ton of developers that will tell you, I don't care what are your reasons for the CLA, I'm just staying away. That's my experience. I got people telling me that. Until you have the CLA on the project, I'm not even looking at it. The whole project. I don't want to contribute, but I'm not looking at the whole project on principle. That's my experience. Not saying that's correct, not saying it's fair.
Well, it's
just what it is.
To me, but yeah.
Sure. Maybe. Maybe not.
So I completely changed my positions on CLAs over the last 10 years because I was for it before, I was against it. And it's true. I think you should change your position with new information. And what I really discovered was the argument that became compelling to me to convince me CLAs were bad was that it's effectively saying the license of your project isn't enough. The only CLA I think is any good is it says, I agree that my contributions is licensed under the license of the project. That's a CLA, it's a very minimalist CLA, and it's what Fontana has dubbed inbound equals outbound.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's right, because if the GPL is a good license, then that should be good enough for everybody. And everybody who contributes should say, yes, I agree to the GPL. If Apache is a good license, everybody should say, yes, I agree to Apache. And I don't think you need an extra agreement unless the license is buggy. And if the license is buggy, as Montana would point out, we should fix the buggy license.
There are perfectly good reasons to have CLA, but I would agree that, especially in projects where you have individual developers from very diverse organizations, that it probably is not a good idea. But not every ecosystem, not every developer community is the same. And for some communities, it makes a lot of sense to have that.
Possibly. I'm just saying that if you care about the real community, and by real community, I mean not just three companies sharing a project.
Yeah, that's precisely the kind of community I'm talking about, and those do exist as well.
Right, sure. And I'm not saying that those communities are wrong or there's anything bad. Red Hat has a lot of them. Please.
Yeah, I sort of an example of what you are talking about, I think, because I'm part of Ulysses, which is at the University of Leuven, like a small group of ICT enthusiasts running a sort of small, it's not really a business, but more like a small group doing hosting for students' organizations and stuff. And so we are changing to a non-profit now. And one of the things we have been thinking about is actually a CLA, which is apparently not very good, according to some people. Now, the point is that we have the problem now that people, like 10 years ago, because we exist for like 20 years nearly, and we have a lot of code, like small scripts and stuff, that have been written by people 5 years ago, and they're not clearly under any kind of license. And we have the problem that sometimes other students' organizations ask us, yeah, the script, you guys use it, we know that it exists, that it works this way. We would like to have a look at that. And we have to email someone we hardly know from 5 years ago to ask, yeah, what's the license of this? Can we actually share this? And so internally we have had this argument, is it a good idea to have everybody who becomes a new member as soon as we have become a non-profit, gives all the rights to the software, to the organization, so it can possibly license it while perhaps retaining also the rights of you as a contributor, so like sharing the copyright in some kind of way. But in that case, I think it would not be bad to have something like a CLA.
Let me tell you about the summer project, my last point there, but I can start talking about that now. We have never accepted corporate copyright in summer code. And we don't have a CLA.
Well, that's not...
Well...
Not completely true.
Not completely true.
Slight exaggeration.
No. After some point...
No, but you recently accepted some.
Yeah. I will get
okay.
to that.
Okay.
Wait a second. So, historically, we did not... Well, as soon as the summer project understood something about licensing, we have not accepted corporate copyright. We always asked for the person working to have personal copyright in Samba.
How does the person know they have personal copyright?
We asked those people to go to their employer and get an exception. And this is not something that every project can do, I understand. The Samba project has always had a very small core of developers and then a constellation. And it was much easier for us because we are die-hard GPL people anyway, so you had to get permission for the GPL part. And at the time, there was no company that had really any policy around it. It was new. So if you had to go through that, those hoops, it was as easy to just ask for this thing on top. And the people that were working on Samba at the point for companies were working generally on a pretty critical project, and so those companies didn't really have reason to say no. To the problem of, but what happened when people leave and go away? Well, actually, the reason why we have this policy in Samba is that, at least for our ecosystem, we have a lot more companies going away than people going away. And when a company goes away, you have absolutely no way to get at whatever remains, because you don't even know who has the rights anymore, where they are, who you contact. And even if you were able to find out that the new entity would probably have no incentive to even reply to you. And so for us, personal copyright was fundamental in order to be able to maintain the code, because reaching people is much easier to reach in corporations. Although some people in the US think that corporations are people. So real people actually reply to you. Real people tend to, you know, especially people have been involved and voluntarily provided code to you, tend to have a better stake in the project, tend to some tend to stick around, but even those that go away tend to, you know, reply to you and tend to accommodate you if you have a request, if they can, if it's not too much burden on them. And we never had really big reasons to contact people, although we did relicense some stuff in Samba. We had a big relicenses from GPL 2.3, but that didn't require any contact because we always had the own later provisions. So we, you know, once the team decided the GPL 2.3 was away, we just bulk relicensed. And we assumed that, you know, everybody was okay with that. But we did relicense from GPL to LGPL some components, because we found out that we built a library, we want to share it with more people. In Samba, we have this concept that if you are an open source project, you come to us and say, I really need this piece, but because of the way I construct this stuff, I really need it to be LGPL, we will consider your request. If you're asking for the whole Samba to go LGPL because that will make your product easier, we'll say no. But so we did relicense some pieces.
Yeah, in that last part, the last thing about relicensing, can you give an example of why it would be very difficult for us to not use a CLI of some sort? If we, for example, have a script, we have one script that we have been using for like 10 years or something, which does a scoring system at a really event. And it's now under GPL, but we actively need to change things because, for example, the course could get longer or more teams are added. Now, if we would have to relicense it, we would still have to contact every single developer that worked on that script.
True.
While if we said that, okay, copyright is now not only owned by the person making the difference, but also Ulysses, our organization,
mm-hmm.
that would be perfectly possible, and
sure.
I don't think the developers would mind, so I don't think that the CLA is in every case bad. It's usually bad.
No, I say it's bad for me.
I
don't like
it. Companies, but it's not with, yeah.
Yeah. No, I say CLA is bad for me. I don't like it. And it tends to be attached to a corporation usually. If a CLA is attached to a non-profit, it's probably,
yeah, well,
I put that, it's probably, it may be a very a good idea. I mean, I can't say CLAs are bad for everybody. I really can't say it. It really depends on the nature of the project to some degree. It is three companies that are building something that they only care about, and they really don't care about random contributions from the outside from people that may have a problem with CLAs. Maybe it's okay. For somebody, we didn't want to do that. And yes, we do accept some corporate copyrights now, but what we ask them usually is that, because now companies know about the GPL and because now they have policies, some companies are not really willing to give personal copyright to their employee anymore because they say, no, we are comfortable with GPL, so why are you requesting that? So what we did is that, well, if you really have to commit a body of code, what we can do, and it seems like at least the companies Samba work with, is that you can transfer the copyright to Software Conservancy, for example. And so in that way, we do accept corporate copyright, but we ask for, you know, them, we tell them we really prefer if they transfer copyrights to the conservancy, which they are usually comfortable with because it's a legal entity, it's not a personal project, it's kind of, you know, legal limbo, and so they like that. On the changing your script license, we also do not care too much if some person is not available, because worst case, we just write a single bit of code. I mean, if you have 10 developers and you have 100 lines of code by one and you can't reach him, and you really think that he would be opposed to any license change or you have any reason to doubt it, I mean, you just rewrite those 100 lines and you just remove the need for asking. But that's the worst case. We try to not do that. We have no reason to do that by default.
Yeah.
It's just our way to deal with it.
What's just that? this year we had like this huge problem with like the people helping us with the scoring requesting to check the script because there was some kind of issue, and we had to wait a full week for the person to respond, which left us with 3 days to finish everything.
Yeah, I understand. It might be a problem.
It doesn't really help when people move to Zurich. So yeah.
We never had that kind of problem, you know, needing a week to react. But even if we did have that problem, we would deal with it. I mean, we think the compromise is good enough for us. And just our system. It doesn't have to be everybody's system. And it's completely my opinion that CLAs are bad. I mean, I don't pretend to say that they must be bad. Maybe there are some CLAs that good. I don't know. I mean, the one we use in the Fedora project is not really a CLA anymore. It's probably still technically a CLA. We don't call it that. But technically, it probably is. But it's very, very, very simple and straightforward. It doesn't really require much sign off.
But it doesn't fall through the BSD, right?
MIT.
MIT.
Yeah. But you could put an alternative license on.
Yeah, but it defaults to non-copyleft. Even if you're contributing.
No, the default, I think the default is whatever is the license of the thing you're contributing to.
No, for code, the default is MIT license, but explicitly any contributor can put an explicit license on the code. For content, the default is actually a copyleft license, CC BY SA, the Creative Commons copyleft license.
Yeah, what the point is that if the contributor contributes with the GPL header, it's fine by us. We don't consider it MIT, it's GPL.
Right, exactly.
So basically, the contributor has the choice of the license, okay? Which is
within bounds. Within bounds. That's they can't just do anything they want. There's some,
they have,
some restrictions
on what
you'll
accept. They have to have the legal right to submit the code.
No, what I'm saying is they can't send you the agreement and say, and the license is, you're not allowed to redistribute
this
to the military.
It has to be a free software license, as defined by the Free Software Foundation,
right,
or OSI, you know, or something like that.
Right.
And
right,
they have to have right to do that.
And
they cannot send a batch under the Apache license to a program that is a GPL V2. I mean, they have to send something that is compatible, of course.
Right.
But that's not, I mean, we can see for reviews. There was a question somewhere. Go.
So, you know, what's your personal situation with Red Hat? Do you own your own copyright in code for Samba?
That's an interesting question. So, when I drafted my contract many years ago, I retained copyright on my contributions to Samba because the project required that, and Red Hat was perfectly fine with it. I don't know about the FreeRTF project, what is the actual exact situation with all of the code, because there is a bit of Samba and other things, but to be honest, I don't care even if the code was read as copyright for that part. I'm fine with whatever. Do we still have that?
As long as there are questions, we
can go a little bit. Well, I want to introduce just another argument that it doesn't really have to do much with experience, but I think it might be interesting. Oh,
perhaps one remark for a situation where contribution agreements might be helpful. So I'm involved in a project where a company that's working a lot with free software sees many problems that big companies get the right internally to license their code under a free software license for different reasons. One of them is these companies have no problem that it's free software, but they don't want to be the copyright holder, the licensor, and so on. In this situation, the idea is to construct an association that such companies can transfer the copyright to that association to be licensed under free software license.
That's what we do with conservancy and contributors to Samba code that don't want to just give the code away. But I don't consider that a CLA. Or I mean, I don't.
Technically, yes.
Yeah, to me, the CLA is bad when it's really compulsory against the will of the people who want to contribute, or that creates obstacle for people to contribute. It's completely, you know, voluntary act from the source of the code. Yeah, I mean, just assign the copyright to someone else.
Yeah,
I mean, you want it.
Companies don't want their name on the code, right? Because they're afraid their name will be on it.
That's an involuntary, you know, donation of the code, so I don't really have anything against that. So this is the thing I wanted to say last, copyright with parsec. And this is something I've been thinking about for a long time, but never formalized in any way. And I think, you know, it's quite clear that, and it was pointed today about the ISC, that, you know, pervasive licenses have parasites, and they're really damaging. However, I'd like to point out that copyleft licenses are not excluded from parasites. There can be parasites to GPL distributed software. They come as under caffeine. I have in mind cases where people take OpenOffice repackages for Windows and try to sell it to people. It's their legal right to do that, because maybe that's not, you know, that the license of OpenOffice might not be their best choice. But if you do that with GPL, it's legal. You can package and package and try to sell it to them. There's no restriction to that. But they often do that in a very bad way, you know. It's not really good people doing it. They're not providing services or anything. They're trying to trick people to pay for something that they shouldn't be paying if they knew that it's also available for free. But it's not the good business model where you're upfront about the software being GPL and, you know, going to a customer and say, you know, this is GPL free software, but I provide this and this service on the side, or I, you know, I give you updates, whatever. It's the bad model where someone tries to sneakily make you buy something and maybe even create a scam where they sign you up for a subscription and your credit card is charged for X amount of euros every month or every year or something like that. So those are also parasites of even the GPL, and it would be nice to have a way to better solve this problem. And one way I've seen doing that is trademarks. Because trademarks allow you to set some policies there, maybe. At least, you know, have to rename the software so they cannot ride on the popularity of a piece of software to do their game. But I don't know that is a good idea. Some people are allergic to trademarks in our community, or have been at least in the past, or using trademarks to force additional restrictions, as they call it. So it's just an open question. I mean, is this a problem that we can simply ignore, or is it something that we should address?
Maybe two questions.
Two questions.
Okay. Are you then suggesting licenses like the MPL, which says, like, okay, Mozilla, the name, the Firefox logo, they are trademark, you can use them, but you can use the code? Such things then?
Possibly. That's an example.
Yeah, it also gives the problems with, like, yeah, distros having difficulty with when they want to do a small change, they can't make Firefox, so you get like a typical canonical license.
Yeah, I'm not proposing anything. I'm really, this is a question. I mean, is there anything we can do? Is there a way to use that technique without getting back the problems they have?
I just spent a lot of years working on a project that has this exact problem.
Can you share the experience some way?
Yeah, that problem absolutely exists. The people out there will harm the reputation of your project by doing things that the license allows them to do, but that you wish they wouldn't do. And there isn't any language in the license you can use to stop them if they're complying. You know, they deliver the source code or written offer or whatever the license obligates them to do. We also had a trademark and spent enormous amounts of money and time managing the trademark around the world, which is a non-trivial exercise. Yeah,
that's a problem.
And we have spoken to a number of well-regarded open source attorneys about the fact that, yes, you could absolutely consider that to be a additional restriction, and thus your software is not actually under the GPL version 2. It's really somebody's opinion somewhere if it ever gets to that. So it's a very, very difficult problem. Yeah. And the worst problem is the one that he just alluded to, is that drafting some policy that can conclusively define what is allowed modification that you can still use the trademark and what's disallowed is nearly impossible. totally subjective, at which point it's not a policy anymore, it's just a, please don't do this, and if you do something I don't like, we're going to come after you.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I think we're out of time. Thank you, Simo.
Thank you.
So it was quite a while ago, but I remember the talk being really interesting.
Well, I think that given the current climate about CLAs, what Simo was saying negatively about CLAs is...
Well, the timing is kind of perfect for us to record this.
I suppose that's true, although it'll be a bit late. Maybe we'll know how the OpenStack thing sorted out, but there was... I wrote a blog post for Conservancy about CLAs, and then Node.js dropped their CLA, and there was a huge thread on Floss Foundations about CLAs.
Mm-hmm. The tide is turning.
I suppose. Well, I like Larry Rosen claims that the reason we have CLAs is because of these horrible free software developers who are trying to rip off projects and companies.
I have to say that your response to Larry Rosen was one of the best mailing list responses I've ever seen.
My earlier response was earlier post, yeah.
Where,
so you can say it because there's no Chatham House rule or anything with Floss Foundations.
Well, I'm saying what you said anyway, and you would be here to object, and you actually will probably be the one to send the audio files to Dan, so you could simply not... You could edit it out if you didn't want me to. So
okay.
So, but anyway, I don't remember. Do you remember what he said? So
he
I guess
said, he said Bradley wants all software to be free. What a dreamer!
Yeah, and Bradley said, Larry, you may say I'm a dreamer, but I'm not the only one.
Well, and then I said, I hope someday you'll join us, Larry.
Yes, so great.
Yeah, there was a side thread about whether I infringed on Lennon's copyrights. Off list.
Was there? I missed that.
I argued I had a fair use defense,
mm-hmm.
which I clearly do. So, besides, I think his copyright should have expired by now, because that was released in 1971. So, copyrights from 71 should have expired by now.
Well,
I mean, it should have in a just
right,
policy.
And that's on the underlying work, not in the recordings, because the recordings were found to have had some common law coverage. Remember, like, the whole Beatles copyright situation that caused those works to be still under copyright long after they should have expired? So weird. It's pretty terrible. But the recording stuff is a bit confusing.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, so back to Simo's talk.
Well, and he talked about encountering GPL first, which probably doesn't happen as much anymore. The people encounter copyleft licenses before.
Probably first.
No, I mean, all these JavaScript people,
that's true.
Permissive MIT license is the first thing they see, or ISC license or something like that. I mean, they were so confused in the JavaScript community that they thought to make something compatible with GPL, you had to dual license GPL permissive MIT.
Mm.
I mean, these are the level of, basically, it's eternal September of licensing. And I think everybody has to reinvent, and we're going back through the BSD period now where people are doing everything under non-copyleft.
Yeah.
And not realizing what they're giving up.
Yeah. I think people often have to learn the hard way, I guess. Well, although it's hard to know what's going to happen, you know? It's really hard to predict.
Well, and Simo talked about the how he felt about what non-copyleft licenses are useful for, and that the problem space that you're thinking about should decide some amount of your license choices, mm-hmm. which I probably agree with. I think even there's this statement on FSF's website that they even agree with that. The Apache Software Foundation's misquoted that from time to time, but they mm-hmm. basically say for certain things, like Simo said, with reference implementations, that non-copyleft licenses are a better choice in some cases.
So there was actually an episode of the Software Freedom Law Show, one of the very early episodes, where we described that as being sort of social versus antisocial behavior in terms of choosing a license of a community. And at that time, it was because we knew of someone who was contributing to a permissively licensed project, but doing so by slapping the GPL on his contributions.
Yeah, but that show's non-free, isn't it?
That show's non-free.
That's Software Freedom
Law Show. Actually, I don't know what the licensing is on that show.
Did you ever get it fixed before you left?
I got an agreement that it would be fixed. I don't know if it was ever implemented.
Oh, okay. I just figured that I would say that because it was funny.
But
because you used to like...
I did. I used to like no derivs. I was really paranoid about it.
It's pretty...
I think a lot of us did. And we've kind of come around to it because non-free licenses are.
And Seema didn't actually talk about any non-free, like how developers. Actually, that would have been an interesting addition to his talk, how developers feel about non-free licenses.
Yeah.
But I guess he's not an expert in that because he doesn't talk to many developers who encounter non-free licenses.
And also as the audience,
I don't understand. Like on the news, they were talking recently about how many weeks it would take to read all of Facebook's agreements and Google's agreements about half as long, but it would still take weeks. And I don't agree to these things. I said LinkedIn was the worst, actually. But these agreements, it was the longest. Mm. But I just don't understand why. And I, because of two shows ago, I accidentally watched that Tom Preston Warner video again.
Which one?
This is the one I mentioned when we talked about Fontana's talk. And when I was preparing the show notes for that show, I wanted to make sure I had the right video to link to of his keynote where he said basically the GPL, like you have to go back to first principles. First principle is freedom and the GPL doesn't meet that because it's too long.
Oh, right.
And so I'm going back to that. I'm thinking like, I was just thinking about like how long a GitHub's terms of service is longer than the GPL, I think. And it's sort of like what people don't.
People are okay with terms of service. It's really weird to me.
It's stupid. It doesn't make any sense to me because these terms of service are very restrictive. And I think in some cases, some of them contradict GPL or make it difficult or cause you Section 7 problems in V2 and all that sort of thing. And nobody wants to listen to me. Nobody cares about that issue.
I don't think that nobody cares about the issue. I think people actually feel kind of helpless about terms of service, and they don't necessarily take them very seriously either. And so I think they underestimate the problem. And then secondly, even if they do appreciate that there's a problem, it's really not clear about what to do. I mean, I've had terms of service changed with companies, but in order to do that, I had to kind of put together coalitions of organizations that had an interest and approach the companies.
Just don't use these services. Don't use Twitter. Don't use Facebook. Don't use LinkedIn.
I mean, I agree with you, except
it's so simple. It's so simple to solve this problem.
I've really kind of, I mean, as people know, I'm now using Twitter sometimes because I feel like I need to in order to be, you know, to be heard. And it's tough. I mean, I don't know. And you need to adopt all of these terrible terms of service to just use basic services like banking services. Every website, everything we do has a website interface that has some terrible terms of service that they then update without properly notifying you, which has legal ramifications. But still, most websites, if you've seen most services now, when you log in, often have ticked a "I agree to new terms of service" or that's the newest wave. Mm-hmm. And it's really disturbing because, first of all, people don't understand the terms of service, even if they do click through. And those people, I mean, most developers would understand the terms of service if they took the time to read them. But who has the time? Because it takes some, you know, they're so complex and involved, which is what you were talking about before.
The only online banking that I do is on Conservancy's behalf, not my own behalf. So I think we need to boycott these things. I don't understand.
Yeah, I agree with you.
This is sort of off topic. Seema didn't talk about this.
Maybe we should get back to Seema's talk. I totally agree with you. I try to avoid services, but when it comes down to it, I really want to maintain a Facebook account so that people will invite me to parties.
Well, that's just not important enough.
It's not. You're right.
Developers.
I don't post anything on Facebook, but that's a little bit of an overgeneralization. People do contact me on Facebook for software freedom related things, which is upsetting, but it's often the only way that people think of to get in touch with you. And if you're not easy to get in touch with, they'll get in touch with somebody else.
Well, I think that what matters to me here is whether, is basically what Seema was talking about, is that developers are the most likely people that are going to look into this issue of the licensing of software. I think Seema didn't say that, but I think from the context, it's kind of true. And that's why I really wanted him to give that talk, was because he's purely developer, really, and he got involved in licensing and interested in licensing just because it was in his face. It was there. And like he talks about being introduced through the GPL. And so from that point of view, I think it's really important. I think we have to talk to developers about this because they're the ones likely to actually bother. Because nobody's going to bother. Nobody cares anymore. And it disturbs me that developers don't care about these terms of service issues. Lawyers don't care. I can't get anybody interested in the fact that, for example, my view is certain terms of service probably contradict GPL, and I can't get anybody to care. Everybody says no, they find these bizarre ways to say that it doesn't, because,
well, that is a complex analysis.
If it did, well, then basically people want they're biased to a certain outcome, because if this contradicts the GPL, there's a slippery slope where all these terms that people are agreeing to are contradicting GPL, and we can't go down that terms that's that slippery slope. And it started with the Red Hat services agreement. So I just worry about that situation of these other agreements impacting licenses. So I'll have to get Simo to come back next FOSDEM and give a talk on that if he wants to.
Yeah.
I don't know if he wants to.
I bet he doesn't.
No.
But maybe he will.
So are we, do we have any FOSDEM talk? I think we have no recording
left.
Are
we done?
I think we might be done. Well, I should load the FOSDEM page just to be sure.
Why don't we do another section where we'll talk about what's to come.
And what's to come with what?
With our show.
I don't know. How are we going
to
figure
Fade
that
out? Fade out to music. So we're done with FOSDEM.
Yeah, the last talk we didn't have a good enough recording of, so we're done with all the FOSDEM 2013 talks that we had. The issue is what we do about 2014, and only a few people sent in opinions on that. And the key thing that I wanted an answer to, I haven't come to a clear conclusion, which is that everybody's in agreement that they want to hear what we think about the FOSDEM 2014 talks, but no one has really answered the question of whether it's important or not to put the audio in. And I can't figure out what the right solution is. Because the audio is widely available, because all the FOSDEM talks were recorded this year, which was very good. The Debian video team coordinated to record them. So they're all available online. And the thing that I don't have an answer to is, should we put the audio in the episodes like we did with 2013 or not?
I'm sort of inclined
not to. No
one
has an answer.
Because the videos are available.
The problem is that if somebody just downloads the Ogcast and takes it with them, they might get stuck with an Ogcast they can't really listen to.
I mean, are we definitely going to cover all of those talks too?
Well, if we do it at all, that's this issue. This is the thing we need an answer to. This is the thing I need an answer to.
I get it.
And no one has an answer.
I don't have an answer.
Well, we're just going to do one of the things.
Nero.
That's telling me I have an appointment.
And with that, I guess we should go.
Yeah, we have an appointment. Karen and I have a conference call we have to do. So, and my computer was telling me this is, if you are on an appointment with me, that's what it tells me every time. So we're gonna do a conference call. I guess if people want to write in again to say whether we should include the audio, I think we're just gonna make a decision.
We'll just make a decision. I don't think people need to write in again. The few people that had strong opinions were already told us what those were.
Yeah, but I don't think anybody has a strong opinion on that. I don't know. I mean, I'm inclined to put it in because you can just speed through it. But what do I know?
More than I do.
Yeah. I think actually, I remember I figured this out. I forgot that I figured this out. The answer is this. What we do is we put the audio in, but we have to make a good estimate of the time signature. And that's tough because we don't know the exact time signature. But we can say roughly you're going to speed to this far ahead. Like the audio, you need to go this many minutes ahead to pass the audio.
I see.
That's, and that way people can speed through and they know how far to speed through. Because the whole bookmarking thing in OGG and MP3 files, it never works right, I'm told. That's the answer, is we have to record when to speak, because we don't normally say that, because we don't know exactly the time index. We have to give a rough estimate so people can speed through it.
But if we talk about each of those FOSDEM 2014 shows, those are episodes through, I mean, that's a lot of talks.
Yeah, well, anyway.
Sorry, what was that?
We have a lot of content. What's the problem? It's not nice filler for us, less work for us, Karen.
But there's so much to talk about.
Oh.
Well, we'll see. Maybe we'll do some.
Okay.
Okay.
So we may not do it at all at this point. So you may never hear a FOSDEM talk on the show again. This may be the last FOSDEM talk you ever hear.
It may be. Praise and Freedom is produced by Dan Lynch of Pod Factory and can be found at podfactory.org. Thanks to Mike Tarantino for our theme music. This episode of Praise and Freedom is licensed under the Creative Commons Attribution ShareAlike 3.0 United States license. You can follow Praise and Freedom Bradley and Karen on Identica, and also read Bradley's and Karen's blogs. Links can be found on the Free as in Freedom website, faif.us. That's FAIF.us. I mean, you know, so... Okay.
Yeah.
We can pick it up.
Bradley. No. It's fine. We
We'll just record it after.